Welcome back, everybody. I'm Richard Krause. That's Bob Reed over there. We're sitting in for Rashmi Nair. Lots to talk about in this half hour. A little bit later on, we want to hear what you were doing around 3 years ago, right now, when it all changed and we all became mole people and moved inside. You'll be able to call us 416-872-1010 and let us know a little bit about that. Right now, though, we want to bring in an expert on banks' failures. And listen, there's been so much of this in the news lately that it's been kind of making me feel a little unsettled. The Silicon Valley Bank has collapsed. So we have Brett House, professor of professional practice and economics at the Columbia Business School and a fellow, this is a long title, with the Public Policy Forum, the Monk School, and Massey College. Brett, welcome to The Rush.
Good afternoon. Nice to be on with you.
Tell me how the Silicon Valley Bank failure is different from the Washington Mutual collapse in 2008, the collapse that kind of signaled a real panic back then.
Yeah, it's distinctly different, though it's on a similar scale. It is not a byproduct of problems on the housing side of a bank's lending books. Mm. It is really a result of some banking 101 errors by the people who led this bank, who were probably better venture capitalists and investors than they were bank managers. Evidence shows that they moved a lot of their liquidity into very long run debt at the same time as the Fed in the U.S. started raising interest rates. That immediately started reducing the value of that debt, because if you've contracted bonds at a given interest rate and then interest rates generally go up, that bond is less attractive than it previously was. They then moved a whole bunch of those bonds into something called their hold-to-maturity book, which means they were promising that they would just hold on to them forever, let them mature and roll off so they wouldn't have to book any of those losses. That left them with very little liquidity on hand when the tech sector companies that they financed and that held deposits with them started encountering funding problems and reducing those deposits, and they got hit by a liquidity squeeze. So this is really bad treasury management. It's not, you know, a byproduct of a housing sector issue or riskiness in terms of who they were lending to. It's really bad management by that bank.
Brett, this sounds like stuff that just plain shouldn't have happened. It just shouldn't have gone on. So are the regulators is there going to be trouble here for the guys who are running these banks?
There ought to be big questions to both the banking industry in the U.S. and the regulators, because unlike many other countries in the world, in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, which led to much stronger regulatory oversight of financial sectors in most industrialized economies, the banking industry in the U.S. lobbied for a carve-out from some of the strictest regulations for smaller and regional banks. And it meant that Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, the other bank that failed, and Silvergate were all exempt from some of the toughest oversight and regulation. And I think what this episode shows is that banking regulation needs to be tight, because excesses happen almost inevitably around the margins of it. And I think we can be thankful that in Canada we have maintained a tighter and more comprehensive approach to regulating our financial sector.
Is there anything to this idea that they essentially served mostly technology workers and venture capital backed companies? Does that raise a red flag? Because when I think of venture capital companies, backed companies, or technology, I think big risks. I think, you know, crypto. I think all sorts of situations where lots of money can be lost very quickly, or certainly moved around in ways that aren't always beneficial. So is that any part of this equation?
Not that I've seen so far in any of the analysis and evidence that's come out. There is no sign of malfeasance, and there certainly isn't a sign that the decline in the value of crypto assets, which I think it's a stretch to even call them assets, the big crypto Ponzi scheme, has affected them in any way. It really is bad liquidity management, kind of banking 101, as I mentioned before. They do bank a lot of Silicon Valley companies, and we haven't seen this blow up come out of, you know, failures on the loan side and the financing side to those companies. And I don't think one of the lessons from this is that the innovation economy and financing it should be seen as riskier than it ever was before. You know, the bank played a very important role in providing financial services to the innovation sector in the Bay Area. But two things to take away is that if you're good at innovation and you're good at venture capital investing, you might not necessarily be good at running a bank. And secondly, one of the problems with this bank is that a lot of depositors had very large holdings with the bank. Mm-hmm. And on the federal deposit insurance guarantee, anything above $250,000 is technically not covered. And in this case, because of the potential confidence hit the bank's failure provided to the rest of the financial industry, the Federal Reserve acted to cover depositors as a whole. And that sends a really bad message to a whole section of the economy that says fail fast and fail often, except, you know, when it means their deposits. They knew those deposits were not protected. Nevertheless, they're getting bailed out. And what it says to everyone is, I think the market cannot regulate banks. We need to have strong regulation in place.
So help me out on this, Brett, because when I saw originally that people basically weren't going to lose their shirts on this, and Joe Biden, the U.S. president, made some comments this morning that, look, the overall banking system is safe, and anybody who was with these banks is going to have access to their money. At first, it sounded like they were very well and thoroughly insured. But what I'm hearing from you is they're getting bailed out by the feds in the U.S., correct?
The depositors are, because the problem with those concentrated deposits is that a very large portion of the depositors in this bank had more than the federal insurance ceiling of 250K with the bank. And so what it says is that a bank that has very concentrated depositor bases, you know, does probably present a bigger risk for the federal deposit insurance cover than would otherwise be the case. And the action to cover the deposits above 250K is a bailout. It's also the case that, you know, the feds in Washington said they're not bailing out shareholders. Shareholders and management are both being taken to zero. But shareholders and management have had years of returns that aren't going to be clawed back. So it's not quite the case that they're getting taken down to zero.
All right. We've only got about a minute left. So I want to know how this happened so quickly, because industry analysts were saying on Friday, oh, the bank's probably still in pretty good shape. It's not a bad investment. And now we're sitting here on Monday talking about this. How did that happen?
That is characteristic of a bank run. When, you know, people collectively decide a bank is going to have a liquidity problem, everyone heads for the doors. And a liquidity problem can become a solvency problem in almost no time, which is precisely why the kind of treasury and cash management errors that this bank made need to be regulated against more strictly than has been the case in this part of the U.S. financial sector. And I'd emphasize, I think we have stronger regulation here in Canada, and the results speak for themselves. We didn't have bank failures in 2008, and I don't see any on the horizon here.
That's good to hear. Brett House, we appreciate your analysis on this stuff as always. Brett is professor of professional practice in economics at the Columbia Business School and a fellow with the Public Policy Forum at the Monk School and Massey College.